We will take the hearings this morning in the order as printed on the agenda. House Bill 2667, 2386, 2387, 2594, and Senate Bill 171. Council, give us the summary on House Bill 2667, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2667 comes from us from Representative Wayne Shetterly from the Oregon, House Bill 2667 comes to us from the Honorable Representative Lane Shetterly on behalf of the Oregon Rehabilitation Association. And what this bill does is repeal a sunset clause on a law that was passed in the 97 session. And I am going to defer to Representative Shetterly the person that we have.
Do you have anything you wish to add on that bill?
Madam Chair, only that I'm dying to hear from Nanheim.
She hasn't signed
it. Who has, Jody?
Tim Crawl.
Oh, really? Okay, whoever.
Tim Crawl, please.
While we're waiting for Mr. Crawl, I will let you know that there was a mix-up with LFO, and they didn't realize that this was on the schedule. They did a quick look at it Friday afternoon, and I was told that their preliminary hit was that there would be no fiscal, and in fact, any possible fiscal impact might come if this bill did not pass, with the idea that if the tort claims limitations don't apply, then the state could see fiscal impact because they've been helping to fund these organizations.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Representative Shetterly.
Thank you. I will just make a few comments. Since this comes from 1997 when I was on this committee. Basically what this bill does is it extends the tort claim limits that apply to the state and to public agencies to these nonprofit community organizations that provide housing and jobs to persons with disabilities. They provide these under contract with the state. And so basically the state is extending through its contracts with these providers the same limitation of liability that applies to the state itself. My understanding in talking with the proponents of it before the session is that this has not presented a problem, and I don't think there's any opposition to removing the sunset either. I think we established the sunset just to give us a chance 4 years later to look and see what the impact of the law has been. And at this point, I don't think there's anything to suggest that it's worked other than as it was intended.
Mr. Crawl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Tim Crawl. I'm director of the Oregon Rehabilitation Association. We're a nonprofit trade association that represents nonprofit community providers across the state, including many of those in your districts, Living Opportunities in Medford, CCI, Partners in Community Living, Edwards Center, and so on. Representative Shetterly has essentially said it. This bill was introduced at our request in part because as Fairview was being closed, a number of the nonprofit boards were quite concerned about taking on individuals who were quite a liability risk. And they were concerned that a huge lawsuit could shut them down. And so we requested that this bill be introduced from Senator Bryant. And it was, and the bill was successful in that respect. We have closed Fairview. All these people live in the community. And in addition, we were able to negotiate a group rate with an insurance company at a reduced rate because of the limitation. So we support the elimination of the sunset, and thank you.
Thank you. The panel have any questions for Mr. Crawl?
I have a question.
Representative Ringo.
Thank you. I'd like to understanding as to the scope involved, the number of wards, the number of institutions. Can you give any estimates?
Madam Chair, Representative Ringo, the number of what?
Wards.
People. Okay. Yeah, I said wards. In terms of, there's now about, counting is if you're talking 24-hour services, there are about 5,000 people, over 4,000 people with developmental disabilities, which is what this applies to in our communities around the state.
And how many institutions? Is hundreds?
Oh, in terms of nonprofit organizations that serve these people, a little over 100.
Okay.
And in terms of who this applies to, because it's restricted to those who get half or more of their budget from that source, from Developmental Disabilities State Office, that cuts it about in half. So it would only apply to about 50 of those.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions?
Madam Chair.
Excuse me, Representative Shetterly.
I think it is important, you just touched on that, that one of the qualifiers for this is that the entity must receive more than 50% of its budget from the state. Again, the idea being that these are essentially state people for whom the state was providing services. The state has closed these facilities and moved them out, and so it's really a matter of necessity that these private nonprofit homes have taken up the slack that the state has left from the closure of its facilities. And so I think that was the rationale in 1997, that where you are talking about these facilities that are basically providing the same services that the state had been providing before, that we would extend that same limitation on liability. And also I think it's worth noting that they've negotiated a group rate on liability insurance. These are in organizations too that typically are working on a shoestring and don't have a lot of margin, so I think that every penny saved on insurance costs and others is one that can go into services for these people.
Thank you. Any further questions, Mr. Kroll? Thank you very much. Anyone else wish to speak on this bill? Okay. Thank you. I'm going to close the hearing on House Bill 2667 and open the work session, House Bill 2667. Discussion. Representative Shetterly.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2667 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Any further discussion? Being none, roll call, please.
Aye.
Representative Lowe.
Excuse.
Representative Ringo.
Aye.
Representative Shetterly.
Aye.
Representative Williams?
Aye.
Chair Walker?
Aye.
Sorry about that.
I'll carry it.
Thank you. House Bill 2667 will be moved with a due pass recommendation to full committee, and Representative Shetterly will carry his own bill. Thank you. I'm going to open the work session on House Bill 2386. Ms. Chartel, would you give us an update, please?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. As the committee knows, House Bill 2386 comes from the Oregon Law Commission, and it is a large project involving revising the laws relating to garnishment. My understanding is that the various groups that had some problems with the bill have gotten together and worked with Mr. Hendricks, so we might call Mr. Hendricks up to talk about the changes that the Dash 1 amendments propose. I'd also like to inform the committee that I did speak to LFO late last week, and they said that they are changing the fiscal statement on this bill from no impact to minimal impact. They estimate that there would be some increased printing costs based on some of the requirements of the bill, but that would be minimal.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Williams.
I'm confident increased printing costs because we're going from four garnishment forms to a single form, so that somehow 4-to-1 increases printing costs.
It does, it does.
All right. Great.
Dave Hendricks, please.
Use money to save from the last bill.
Maybe because they can't use the current supply.
I guess.
Mr. Hendricks.
Chair Walker, members of the committee, Dave Hendricks, Legislative Counsel's Office. You have, should have a rather large set of amendments to the bill, but to tell you the truth, I think it's one of those situations where it looks like it's a lot more going on than actually is as far as the amendments. I did want to talk about the principal issue that was discussed by the group that got together to look at, one of the last outstanding questions that had not fully been addressed by the work group because of time limitations and other things, the interim work group, I should say. And the people who basically came in to talk about the issue last week were Brad Swank for the Judicial Department, Randy Jordan from the Department of Justice, Ken Sherman from the Bank Association were all present. And afterwards, I did supply a copy of these amendments to Jim Markey of the Collectors Association, who also has, of course, a big interest in this bill. And they've all looked at the amendments and are happy with them as they now stand, at least that's what they all told me on Friday, and I think that's still the case. The big issue that was left outstanding related to a thing called notices of garnishment, and I have to explain that real quickly. Most practicing attorneys deal with writs of garnishment. They are the standard thing that you issue when you have a judgment and you want to collect on it. A notice of garnishment is a hybrid garnishment that is used by state agencies who have authority to issue warrants. And we're primarily talking about Department of Revenue, who issues warrants for taxes, but also can issue warrants to collect debts on behalf of any state agency, money owing to the state. So it is a money issue. It's an important issue because, obviously, to the extent people owe money to the state, you know, the state wants to collect it so that it's not money you have to otherwise appropriate to cover. The notice of garnishment is kind of a super writ, I guess, because, for instance, the most noticeable aspect about it is with a regular writ of garnishment, when you issue it, you can collect wages for 90 days from the debtor. With a notice of garnishment, if you issue it, you can collect it until the debt is paid. So it's really a continuing writ. It goes on, or continuing notice, I should say. It goes on and on. One of the problems that's been outstanding under the existing law is that because these notices are issued without a judgment, there is no judgment, the court doesn't have any paperwork for them when, for instance, the debtor says, I think that this property you've glommed onto is exempt, that you can't use this property towards satisfying this debt that's owed to the state. And the question has always been, well, where do you file? A, where does the debtor file the claim that it's exempt? And B, how does it get resolved as far as who gets to decide? In a normal writ, the court does all of this, a circuit court. And the bill goes to great efforts to try to identify for all the writs which court is the court that everybody's going to be looking to as being the court with authority over the writ. But the notice is kind of out there on its own because there is no court involved. There's never been a judgment. There's never been any paperwork filed with the court. And so in order to clarify, the final decision was to basically clarify in the statute what's going on now. And what's going on now is that those claims of exemptions are currently going back to the agency, not to a court, but to the agency. There's no court on the specified on the notice of garnishment, so the debtor, you know, it's kind of hard to go to the court when there's no court specified where do you go. So they're going back to the agency, and we're going to clarify in the language that's what happens, that the debtor needs to file the claim of exemption with the agency, and then the agency is directed basically to resolve those claims of exemption.
Madam Chair?
Representative Shetterly.
Dave, when you say the agency, is that going to be the Department of Revenue? Or you know, because a lot of agencies assign claims to the Department of Revenue, so in that case, then which agency does it go back to?
Chair Walker, Representative Shetterly, it's almost always going to be the Department of Revenue. In fact, it's almost always going to be the Department of Justice and Mr. Jordan and his crew who are going to be handling these. So as a practical matter, they're going to be coming back to DOJ in one form or another. And the agency will be, DOR will be the one who's going to be doing it. My understanding is that there have been a variety of, you know, that there have been, for instance, administrative hearings on these of some sort or another. It's one of those things where, in clarifying the law, it might be something that eventually the legislature wants to come back and spell out a little bit about how the agency should handle these, as far as how they should resolve these claims of exemptions. But at least it's now clear in the law, and that resolved a lot of the issues as far as with both the courts and the Department of Justice about how this piece of the bill was going to work. Beyond that, the amendments do a lot of cleanup things. There were several things that we had noted in looking back over the bill where people had suggestions both from the Judicial Department and DOJ about little improvements, not terribly significant changes, but things that will make it a clearer, easier bill to read. We did have a request from Process Server with respect to some changes that he thought would be improvement, and we did incorporate one or two changes there, although some of the things that he was asking for were either things that the work group during the interim had discussed and decided to go a different direction, or were things that clearly would be a major change in the current law that places where the bill currently doesn't go. At least certainly we wouldn't go without a lot of discussion from the work group. So that's pretty much what these the Dash 1 amendments will do.
Any further questions? Mr. Hendricks. Thank you. Okay, further discussion? No discussion.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Williams.
This is obviously, this garnishment bill has been a, I guess I didn't get my stack of amendments here, but this garnishment bill has been a long worked on project. An effort with a lot of people, and I know we knew that we'd have some continuing work to do when it got into the process. It wouldn't surprise me if, I borrowed Vic's here. Wouldn't surprise me if by the time it got over to the Senate, we'll have a few other little things to probably correct, but that's the nature of this kind of comprehensive reform. So with that, I would move the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2386.
Thank you. Any discussion? Oh, Representative Shetterly.
Just a... I see that a number of the people from the work group from the Law Commission are here this morning. I did anyone indicate that they have any questions or
work session?
I'm just curious if since we've not heard these before. If
in agreement with
group,
Mr. Hendricks' amendments comments. Doesn't look like it.
Show of hands. Anybody needs to tell us something about this? Okay, I'm fine. I just want to give them the opportunity.
All right. Any objection to the amendments to House Bill 2386? Seeing none, the amendments are added to the bill.
Madam Chair.
Representative Williams.
I'd move House Bill 2386 as amended to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Any discussion? Okay, roll call, please.
Representative Batson?
Aye.
Representative Lowe?
Aye, excuse, yes.
Representative Rindholz?
Aye.
Representative Shetterly?
Aye.
Representative Williams?
Aye.
Chair Walker?
Aye. House Bill 2386 is moved to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Thank you. We're going to get done early. Who would like to carry this to our committee?
I'd be pleased to carry it to the full, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Williams.
Since it's my life's work now.
Well, I was wondering if you're going to jump in on that.
My great legacy.
This is your legacy.
Your take-home bill.
Father of Oregon
Parish. I'm sure your constituents will understand every bit of it.
They're very proud of me, I'm sure.
Years from now, law students will be taking your name and... Maine. Remember that, Representative Williams. Okay.
Okay. Open the work session on House Bill 2387. Council.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2387, as members of the committee will recall, deals with the issue of partition of land and when two property owners get to the point where they can't agree, one of them petitions for partitionment of the land or the property, and under current law, the person that has requested the partition is not able to be the one that can buy it. So what this bill would do would be to allow either party, depending on what decision the judge makes, what's the most appropriate decision. We had Mr. Leuenberger testify by phone last time that we had this bill, and the only change that the Dash 1 amendments make is that now the money is, rather than being paid into the court, proof of payment needs to be filed with the court. You'll see on line 14.
Thank you, counsel. Any discussion? We lost two of our members here.
Yeah, because Max doesn't count towards quorum.
But Max doesn't count to the quorum. Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
So we've got three of five, right?
We've got three of the five. Okay.
Madam Chair, I just have a question.
Yes, Representative Wingo.
Frankly, I can't remember the initial discussion on this. Maybe I was just not really with it that day, or I wasn't here. But does this... since it allows judge in action for a partition to make an order permitting an owner, does that mean that the owner has to acquiesce in that decision to take out a loan, or the judge can actually order that person to borrow money?
Is there anyone here that is familiar with this bill?
That wasn't discussed the first time, and I don't think it's an issue of them ordering. I think it's more a sense of authorizing so that they then can use the property in order to take the loan so they can purchase it from the other party. But they're the ones that they're fighting over the property.
Right.
So I would assume that they're going to do whatever they need to do in order to purchase the property. So I don't think that's an issue.
There was the Maupin. Do you have a copy of the Maupin case? Do you have a copy of that?
No, I don't have a copy of the Maupin case.
I have one here. You can... When Mr. Leuenberger requested the bill from Senator Bryant, basically the idea was to clarify and in a sense change the outcome of Maupin versus Opie. The way that the Court of Appeals read the law in that case is that the statute limits the purchase of a partition property to the defendant. And Mr. Leuenberger and others felt that what that does is end up allowing people to sort of blackmail or have undue power. It doesn't give sort of put both people on equal footing. The person that finally caves in and goes to the court isn't allowed to purchase the property in the partition, and so this would just put them on equal footing, but it doesn't take the judge out of the process. The judge is the one that makes the determination as to who should get it.
Okay.
Does that clarify it for you?
That helps.
Okay.
Madam Chair?
Yeah.
I feel quite good about this because my notes would indicate the same thing, so apparently listen well on that particular day.
and hopefully I'm saying it right then.
That's what I have.
All right, good.
Okay, we have an amendment to this bill. You have the amendments there, too?
Yes.
Okay. And I think the only issue that came up that day that was that
that what called for this amendment, where it says payment in court, rather than having it go into the court, that they have to submit a proof of payment filed with the court. Okay. All right.
Madam Chair, I move the dash one amendment. So.
Okay. Any objection? Being none, the amendments are adopted to House Bill 2387. I entertain a motion for the bill.
Madam Chair, I move the House Bill 2387 go to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you.
As amended.
As amended.
Thank you. Thank you. Roll call, please.
Representative
Bassett? Aye.
Representative Lowe?
Excuse.
Representative Ringo?
Aye.
Representative Shetterly?
Excuse.
Representative Williams?
Aye.
Aye. House Bill 2387, as amended, passed to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Is there someone that would like to carry this bill?
I will go ahead and carry it.
Okay, Representative Ringo. House Bill 2594, we open the work session. Council.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2594 had a public hearing a couple of weeks ago. At that time, there was some question as to whether or not the language needed to be cleaned up, whether or not there needed to be some amendments. In the meantime, the various groups that were interested in this bill have met and talked, and they're not requesting any amendments.
So the situation was resolved.
That's correct. And as you'll note, or you may recall from your notes, there is a fiscal statement or impact statement on this bill, and at this point, the impact is unclear. I think the bottom line is what effect Measure 7 would have. The recent court decision about Measure 7 sort of takes that question out of consideration, at least at this point.
Thank you. Any discussion?
Madam Chair, I remember
Representative Ringo.
During our first hearing on this, Representative Shetterly raised the question as to the way of necessity and what that might entail. And looked at the statute, and it could, the way of necessity could be considered a road, and whether that was a problem. And I'm wondering whether the folks that got together and discussed this considered that and at least came to terms on that.
Council, do you have any comment on that?
I do. I don't know if we need to hear from somebody here. I can tell you that I know that legislative council was consulted about that and about the wording, and the note that I get back from them is that under current ORS 308-400, subsection 2, historic cemeteries have a similar exception to what this bill is requesting. There's a distinction made between historic and pioneer cemeteries, and quite frankly, I can't remember what the distinction is, but this basically expands that exemption from just historic cemeteries to pioneer cemeteries as well. And the information that I get from LC is that this bill would provide a way across land without defining what the way is, as does ORS 308-400 sub 2. Line 18 of this bill allows the owner of the land over which the way passes to determine where it passes. Therefore, this way of necessity can be a path, a road, a bridge, to be determined by the property owner. In fact, it does not require that way to be the same way of passage each time it is granted. As a result, there is no inherent cost to the landowner or person seeking access, nor need for other provisions of ORS 376-150 to ORS 376-200. LC also writes, we did not limit this to non-motorized conveyance, as does ORS 308-400 sub 2, as many pioneer cemeteries are accessible by a private road upon permission of the property owner.
Okay.
That's what I know.
Madam Chair.
Representative Axelrod.
Question to the council, please.
Yes.
Andrea, I noted down here that that there was some concern about a need for an amendment to clarify when access would be given. And I noted, of course, that we're not having an amendment, so apparently that has been worked out. What is the solution?
Well, my understanding, the organization that was originally troubled by this withdrew any request for any amendment and said the bill's just fine. They didn't want to. And so nothing further was done in terms of, I know that Representative Shetterly had expressed those concerns as well. My understanding from the proponents of the bill is that they spoke with Representative Shetterly and to this organization and that this bill, and to LC, and that this bill is written so that it can be, so that it is clear. But we might want to check now with Representative Shetterly to see if he's comfortable with it. In terms of how the bill is written. My understanding was that everybody was on board. That's, I'm talking about 2594.
Oh, sorry. I don't know. Maybe we'll hear from, do you want to hear from the proponents?
Well,
I'm okay with it.
Okay, that's what we want to know.
Everyone was hanging on your,
oh.
your final approval.
We should all defer to you.
Yeah. No, there was, the issue that was brought up in the original hearing has apparently been resolved by the parties, and they have dropped their request for the amendment. And we wanted to know if...
Let's go,
okay.
Madam Chair.
Representative Ringo.
I mean, I don't want to create a problem if there's not one in practice and just...
That's
hypothetically
good.
There could be, so therefore we need to micromanage the wording. But I do recall during the last hearing there was discussion by several people that this left open the possibility of ambiguities in terms of how the scheduling would occur. Is this quarterly per person? Would these things be scheduled so that the property owner can, okay, everybody, you're going to come in on the fourth Monday or whatever of this month? And I don't know how that's been resolved, and I guess I'd like to know, if we're going to pass this bill, what their thinking is.
And if I can just respond.
Yeah, we considered that a legitimate concern, and I'd rather not pass it just because we don't know the answer.
And I'll just respond by saying that my understanding, and maybe we need to get more information from the proponents of the bill, but my understanding is that this language mirrors the other statute that I've cited and that there really hasn't been any problems in terms of that. Whether or not that addresses your concerns, I don't know. But that's my understanding, is that all it's doing is extending, right now the same language exists for historic cemeteries, and it's extending that to pioneer cemeteries, and there hasn't been a problem. That's...
I'm sure.
Representative Ringo.
Perhaps Representative Shetterly can answer this. I am curious as to the difference between the historical cemeteries and the pioneer cemeteries, because to the extent we're greatly expanding the scope, then I think it is important that this is... only slightly expanding the scope.
Madam Chair.
Representative Shetterly.
Thank you. We are this bill does expand the scope, and to the extent that it expands existing law, the existing law is actually in the on lines 12 through 14, and that just describes a way of necessity for non-motorized conveyance to historic cemeteries. That's the reference there to 308A.125. Nothing in the current language actually exists with regard to this quarterly issue, so we'll just have to see how that works out unless we want to spend more time to specify that. But if, you know, it's the proponents, I guess, that are worried about the, that should be worried about the ambiguities here. If they're not, I'm not going to make this my cause celeb for the session to worry about. Although I would say, and I've cautioned them too, this also gives the owner of the parcel the ability to designate the property over which the way of necessity passes, to designate the way of necessity. And that does open the opportunity for a non-cooperative or vindictive subservient property owner to make them wander through the thickets and brush and swamp land to get to the cemetery parcel, but again, it's their bill, and they're satisfied with it. I'm not going to get in the way of Pioneer Progress.
The definition of the Pioneer Cemetery is a burial place that has one or more persons that died before February 14th, 1909, and historic cemeteries do not have that date.
And historic cemeteries are actually cemeteries that have qualified under that statute in Chapter 308 for specific, I think it's a property tax exemption. So that's a very narrowly defined group of cemeteries. This is a much broader group.
That's correct. Any further? You're really thinking about this, Williams?
No, I was just listening intently.
You weren't here the first time. You didn't hear all of it.
Oh, I tuned in on TV.
Oh, you tuned in. Oh, my.
I always watch this committee on television.
You always watch this committee on television. We're very honored to have
you
here today.
Try to rescue us in case we're in trouble.
Rescue us in case we're in trouble. Okay. All right. No further discussion. I would entertain a motion on this bill.
Madam Chair, I move that we pass House Bill 2594 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you, Representative Ringo. Any further discussion? Roll call, please.
Aye.
Representative Ringo?
Aye.
Representative Shetterly?
Aye.
Representative Williams?
Aye.
Chair Walker?
Aye. Okay. House Bill 2594 is passed to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Yes, I will.
Okay.
Okay.
I know. Let's wait next here.
94 is his?
Yes. Yes.
Okay. Representative Williams will carry this bill. Leave the room.
Madam Chair, I wonder if you saw that on TV.
I only had time to get to a television.
I'll give him the leash.
Okay. I would like to, there's no objection, reopen House Bill 2387 so that Representative Shetterly may vote on that. There are no objection. 187, Representative Shetterly.
You reopen the work session on that? Thank you. I'll vote aye.
Thank you. Representative Shetterly votes aye on 2387. I close the work session on 2387.
I think this is remarkable, Madam Chair, that Representative Williams just pops in on a Monday and gets to carry two bills.
Isn't that wonderful?
Did I get that one too?
Yes, you did.
Well, it's your bill.
I'm pleased and proud to carry that bill.
It's not very often that I get to do something like that to you.
Yeah, no, it truly is a pleasure.
I think it's for him.
Okay, we're waiting for counsel on...
She's right there.
Oh, there she is. Okay. You thought you were back in your office.
She had dozed off in that scintillating discussion of Pioneer Cemeteries and garnishments.
Do it to you every time.
I think Doug can probably do it without much waiting. I don't have a name tag.
I have 2, 3, and 5.
Applied amendment on 5.
Exceptionally amended.
Right.
Well, okay. Is there someone that's going to present it again? Yes, I guess so. 2, 3, 5. Probably you want, maybe we should have come up to it and do that.
Ready?
three.
Just to confirm what it does.
Doug can come forward to get on the live, excuse me.
It's probably a good view.
Okay, I'm opening work session on Senate Bill 171. We have had several amendments to this bill, and I would like to have some individuals come up in this work session to discuss these. And first, on the Dash 2 amendment, Ken Sherman.
I just ducked out.
You just ducked? He just went out? Oh, okay.
I'll grab him.
Okay. I didn't see him go out. I was going to say, where is he? That's been going a long way. Let's move on to the next one. Lane, you have a Dash 3 amendment. Would you like to discuss that at this time?
Well, Madam Chair, thank you. The Dash 3 amendments, if you look on page 57, the Dash 3 amendments basically will continue the Secretary of State notice practice with regard to expiring financing statements. To be honest, when I got in, I was looking for that amendment, and I didn't see it. I thought it would take text in order to do that, but in fact, what I see what we've done on line 22 of page 57, we've deleted the specific language that says that refers to financing statements that are expiring, that are filed before the effective date of this act. So, and then also we're deleting lines 32 through 34 that was the language in the bill that said the Secretary of State is not required to mail renewal notices concerning any financing statements filed after the effective date of the act. So those two taken together just continue the notice provisions that are currently in place. And I did get correspondence from the bar and from the Professional Liability Fund that confirmed that indeed even in the work group they had expressed support for that amendment. I think the word we got from the Secretary of State's office that it cost something like $3,000 or $5,000 a year to do this notice. I think it's worth it, the advantage of the notice requirement, even though it may not hit the target in every case where you've had secured parties that have moved or not filed amendments to indicate an assignment or something like that. I think that there are enough cases where I, in fact, in my own limited practice, I have seen this be effective that it strongly merits continuation.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Roche, would you care to comment on this amendment? Where did he go? There he is.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Tom Roush, and I'm with the Secretary of State's Office, Corporation Division, and we administer the Renewal Notice Program. And what I'd like to say is although I don't wish to disagree with Representative Shetterly, in our experience and in our conversations with many folks through the years, this renewal notice program has been more of a problem than a help. First of all, we're the only state that uses this. This is an anomaly. It's a non-uniform provision to the Model Act. And fact, we were recently at a summit of other state administrators, and we talked about this very thing, and they were just shocked that anybody would want to do this, to be honest with you. And no one has ever wanted it. We've had this for a number of years, and no one has ever wanted it. The program has been ineffective. It's been difficult for us. Representative Shetterly referred to the fact that we do get approximately, we basically throw about $3,000, $3,700 down the drain every biennium on postage, because about 25% of our renewals are sent back. They're not non-deliverable. We also get a lot of complaints about this system because we can't fully automate it. We send several envelopes to folks to the same address when we get the right address, and they get these several envelopes on the same day, and are very upset that we're wasting postage. Well, simply, it's because of the, I won't bore you with the details, but because of the way things are put in our files and the way that the system works, we can't fully automate it. It's not an easy system. It confuses people. And we think under RA9, Revised Article 9, it's going to be even more confusing, because simply for the fact that continuations now are not necessarily going to be filed in the same state. So we're going to send a renewal notice out to folks, and people like Representative Shetterly and other folks, lawyers who are very on top of this, are not going to have a problem when we send a renewal notice out. But it's the people who do this very, very rarely. We send out a renewal notice, and they don't even think about it. They send a continuation back to us, and maybe the wrong state, because revised Article 9 changes the jurisdiction that you would necessarily file in. So we're worried that the program will be misleading to filers who are not so astute, and those are actually the filers that this program is designed to help, because astute filers don't rely on this program. We talk to people, we've talked to the big banks and the big law firms, and they say, we already have our own systems. We use you as a backup to our backup. So rightly so. I mean, in this modern day and age, tickler systems are easy to manage. So I would just in summary, I would just like to say that we see the notice system is unnecessary. We think there are better alternatives. The provision is non-uniform, and the program really doesn't work. And so we urge you to keep the language as it is in the bill, and respectfully ask you to deny the amendment. Thank you.
Any question, Mr. Walsh?
Madam Chair.
Representative Shetterly.
Not so much a question. Comments on that. I appreciate, first of all, this is a non-uniform provision. However, it doesn't go to the substance of the article, and I'm satisfied that doesn't offend the uniform nature of the act. Secondly, as to whether or not it works, I guess, and testimony is that, you know, that this misleads the unsophisticated, but those are the very unsophisticated secured parties who would be the ones who would forget the 5-year expiration period anyway. So I think for that group, that's probably 6 of 1, half a dozen of the other, except for those who, when they receive the notice of renewal, will either get it right or will think to walk into the friendly lawyer down the street and say, what does this mean? What do I need to do? Which is exactly how I've had, I'll bet, probably 5 or 6 in my years practicing, where somebody has come in, they've received a renewal notice, and their question is, what do I need to do about this? And it's given us the opportunity to say, well, oh, you've got a financing statement that's expiring. We need to get this notice renewed. It's easy. It's simple. And I'm not going to say it's foolproof, but you know, the scenario that I see in so many of these cases where this notice is critical is the person who has worked their life to build up a business, and it's a small-town Main Street business. They sell their business. They take it. They sell it on terms, because that's the only way they can sell it, and so they take a financing statement to secure a long-term payout, and these are folks for whom their life savings and work are tied up in this business or these assets that they're selling, and they're the ones who are not sophisticated, who don't have the tickler systems, who will get this notice and say, well, gosh, I wonder what this means, and at least this gives them the opportunity to get it right. Now, if they screw up, if they just file in the wrong place, well, that's then, I guess, their fault, but I think that there are more cases where this has helped than not helped. And I don't think that, warts aside, that there's any justification for terminating this notice provision. I think it's extremely important, and especially considering that you know, it doesn't take many cases of having gotten it right and helping people to justify the very minimal cost and expense to this program. Excuse me. Thank you, Representative Ringo.
Madam Chair.
Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Obviously, I'm not an attorney, so this particular issue is very interesting from kind of an abstract point of view, which is the way I kind of approached it. And I kind of think that even though I listen and I understand what Ken, what you said, I think notice is important, even if it doesn't help most people. If it helps just a few, I think it's worth it. And while about one half are sent back, according to the testimony, and it is somewhat expensive in the way of postage, I think it's worth it, just as a general approach to government. I think government should be in a position here to notify people. So I'm going to support Representative Shetterly's amendment if we get that.
Thank you. Thank
Madam
you,
Chairman.
Mr. Rush.
Yes. I'd just like to make one other point, I guess. I heard Mr. Rausch comment that people receive these, and now under the revised Article 9, they might not be aware of what state, that it might create additional confusion. They might then file their continuation in the wrong state. I have every confidence that the Secretary of State's office has the ability in providing that notice to communicate to that individual that they should be sure that they file the continuation in the right state, or that they should check appropriately to determine where they ought to file by some little piece of additional language they can insert in the notice. I think this is an opportunity to advise the ill-informed and the unsophisticated about an issue. And, you know, it wouldn't do them any harm maybe to put a tagline on there: if you have any questions, you should check with an attorney. You know, I mean, how hard would that be? And I have every confidence that the Secretary of State's office can continue to provide this important function and do it in a way that does not confuse people, but actually helps them understand better what their legal rights are.
Thank you, Representative Williams. Thank you for your help.
Thank you.
Okay. No further discussion on the dash three. Okay.
Session?
Pardon?
Are we in work session?
Yes, we're in work session.
Madam Chair, I'll move the dash three amendments to Senate Bill 171.
The dash two or the dash
three? I'm sorry, the dash two amendments? Is that
dash
what
three.
We're... Dash three.
Three,
okay.
Dash three.
Dash three.
And do I hear any objection to the dash three amendments being moved to the House Senate Bill 171? Objection, dash three, Senate Bill 171, dash three amendment is added to the Senate bill. Okay, do we have Ken Sherman? Now we'll talk about the dash two.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Ken Sherman, Jr., counsel for the Oregon Bankers Association. My office is at 687 Court Street here in Salem. The Dash 2 amendments before you deal with essentially two issues. The first of them is the exclusion in the current draft of certain the applicability of Article 9 to certain deposit accounts, bank accounts, if you will. The oversight that we uncovered or discovered during the course of the last two or three weeks relating to these deposit accounts relates to the use of deposit accounts as security for credit cards. We have one particular institution here in Oregon, First Consumers National Bank, which is located up in Beaverton and has a national operation of issuing credit cards that are secured by deposit accounts. These are typically accounts that are acquired by people who have had past credit problems and are trying to get back into a good operating condition with a new credit card. The company takes a security interest in the consumer's savings account or CD, and initially, as I understand the program, they will have a one-to-one match. If the consumer has, say, $500 deposited in the account in which the security interest is taken, the card will be issued with a credit limit of $500. And then as the experience is acquired and the consumer demonstrates good credit worthiness, that limit is increased and eventually goes away altogether. So it's kind of a credit card with training wheels, if you will. And it's been a very effective program. It is, as I say, national in scope. Many thousands of these are issued, and the bank up in Beaverton employs, I think, about 1,300 individuals, so it's of no small economic impact in the state. The uniform draft and the language that I'm referring to is at page 15 of the bill, lines 3 and 4. You see that the existing language says that Article 9 does not apply to an assignment of a deposit account in a consumer transaction. And that's the overly broad language that we're concerned about. Because typically the accounts that we're talking about and the transactions in which those accounts and those cards are used are consumer transactions. We have an existing non-uniform provision in our law, in our Article 9, which allows for these assignments, not only allows for them, but provides that they are covered by Article 9. So what we are proposing to do here is to simply continue the status quo of the law here in Oregon, and to do that we have in the amendments that appear on page 1 of the Dash 2 amendments, lines 1 through 6, simply reinserted the language that is already in Oregon statute that states that Article 9 does not apply to an assignment in a consumer transaction of a deposit account from which checks, etc., may be drawn. So Article 9 will not apply to the assignment of a consumer account upon which checks can be drawn, but it will apply to other accounts in consumer transactions. So if the consumer, as in the first consumer's situation, wants to use the deposit account to secure the credit card, they can do so, and they can do so under Article 9 rather than going to common law to secure that. So that's the change that is set forth in lines 1 through 6 on page 1. The remainder of the amendments that occur on pages 47 and 49 of the Dash 2, they refer to pages 47 and 49 of the bill, came to us from the insurance companies and raised a question about what are called structured settlements. Now, I'm not a trial lawyer, so this is not my area of expertise, but as I understand it, frequently in cases of personal injury and other cases, the judgment that will be recovered is not for the payment of a lump sum, but rather may be structured for payments over a period of time. And the question is the assignability. There's very broad language in this Article 9 that says restrictions on assignment of various property interests, including structured settlements, those restrictions are ineffective. And the concern that has grown up, as I understand it, regarding this language has to do with whether that would apply to these structured settlements. And this is to say these amendments would make it clear that these restrictions on assignability or the restrictions on language that would prohibit assignment are not effective. So the assignment could not be made, and the restrictions that may be set forth in the contract or in the settlement agreement would continue to apply. This Article 9 would not throw those out. I'm not sure whether there are representatives of the group that requested these amendments that are here with us today, but that's my understanding of the effect of those amendments, is to simply narrow the scope of the language in Article 9 that would say restrictions on assignment are not applicable.
Thank you. So any member of the panel have a question of Mr. Sherman on these amendments? Representative Ringo?
Thank you. The original part that's in this the proposed Article 9, that is uniform, and is what your Dash 2 amendment is intended to do, is to vary from the uniform.
As to the assignment question that I just spoke to, yeah, that is correct.
Okay. And I'm encapsulating what you said to make sure I understand it. And the intent is to make it so that the restrictions on the assignments will remain intact.
That's correct. It would allow those restrictions to stay in place. And some of the arguments that have been put forward for doing that, one of the big arguments that I've seen is that if the right to receive money in the future on a structured settlement is freely assignable, that may adversely affect the income tax treatment of those dollars for the recipient, because as you know, the IRS takes the position that if you have constructive receipt of dollars, those dollars may be taxable now, even though you don't receive them until later. And they put forth a lot of case history to show that in those situations, the ability of the judgment holder to assign those future payments may result in their being taxed in the year of the entry of the judgment. So that was one of the big arguments that they were making, to allow these to continue. What Article 9 does that is different from the old Article 9 is to very much more broadly restrict restrictions on assignment. And as I understand it, even though this does vary from the uniform draft, a number of other states have caught this problem and have addressed it in the later states that have adopted Article 9.
Thank you.
Anyone else have a question? No. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Paul Cosgrove, do you wish to make any further comment on this amendment?
No, Madam Chair.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Representative Shetterly.
If it's in order, then I'd move the dash two amendments to
it is in order.
Bill 171.
Okay. Any further discussion on the Senate Bill 171-2 amendment? Any objection? Being none, the dash two amendment is hereby adopted to the bill. Okay, we have Senate Bill 171-5 amendment.
Madam Chair, is it appropriate that I speak to that amendment since I'm the one that's prepared it?
Yes, you may.
Thank you. I would like to offer just a little background on this and then perhaps ask for some testimony by some member of the audience here that can provide some more detail. During the initial hearing, I had asked a question of one of the witnesses whether there was an attorney fee provision included in Article 9 as it relates to the collection procedures, the repossession procedures, and the answer I received was, yes, there is. Subsequently, the gentleman that testified, he was the professor from the University of Oregon, came up to my office and said that he had made a mistake, that he reviewed it, and in fact, there was not an attorney fee provision. The amendment that I'm offering reinstates language that is currently contained in the Oregon statute. It's not uniform, but it currently exists in our statute. I've had discussions with David Niebel about this, and I guess I'd rather not speak for some of the other folks who have interest in this. I'd prefer that they come and testify as to whether they oppose this and what their position is.
Madam Chair, if I could
weigh
in just briefly, I had a chance to have a conversation, I think, with almost everybody who cares about this issue out in the hallway with respect to the Dash 5 amendments. And while there was some confusion initially about its applicability as it currently stands in ORS, the current law in ORS 5070, I think there is now general agreement that the adoption of the Dash 5 amendment as currently written would adopt current Oregon law with respect to the recovery of attorney's fees. There was some additional uncertainty about that on various people's parts, but I think Mr. Sherman, the Bankers Association, the Collectors Association, the Bar, and the consumer groups have all generally agreed that the Dash 5 amendments as written would keep a current provision in Oregon law consistent in the revised Article 9 were it adopted. And with that, the songs of the bagpipes.
Very moving
have
experience.
Have created a stirring and fitting backdrop for this amendment and Article 9. This is a great committee.
Isn't that wonderful? We get all the entertainment through the window.
It does harken back to our evening meeting last.
Yeah, it sure does. There was a theme. If we brought Mr. Marquis up, there would be the theme from Jaws again, I think, like there was last session. With that, I'm going to look out into the group and see if everyone nods with me in agreement. This is what we all heard.
I don't see anybody.
Let the record reflect.
So with that, Madam Chairman, I will just go on the record of saying I support Representative Ringo's -5 amendment.
Would Doug McCann like to come up and explain this amendment any further? No.
You don't have to, Doug.
Don't. You don't have to.
Yeah, I don't think you
need
to.
You're not required to.
No.
Okay, you're not required. Okay. I just want to make sure you had that opportunity. Okay.
Charlie?
I can't move this amendment without changing it.
Why?
I thought I was getting dug up.
Pardon?
As I understand it, this amendment needs some changes to it.
No,
none. You've changed your mind.
Yeah.
Changed his mind. Okay.
Counsel,
okay.
I think everybody out in the hallway had another round while you were dutifully sitting in here and has come to the agreement that that the -5s as written are consistent with the current version of Oregon law.
I appreciate her.
Just so I understand, you were interested in this 10% issue. Is that what you were?
No. Just before this started, I was told that we needed to amend this amendment. And now I guess everyone's changed their mind.
Nothing is static.
just so that I'm not the only one who doesn't
know. The rolling
ball. That's right.
Representative Ringo, if I can, what the concern was that there was a sentence in 79, I'm losing my reference again, 5070, there was concern that the way this amendment was drafted was broadening the right to attorney's fees.
Beyond
current law. When people looked at that statute carefully and compared it to this amendment, the agreement was that this was consistent with current law and was not a broadening.
Okay. Fine.
And I've read the statute and the amendment, and I agree with their analysis.
Thank
well,
you,
with
Representative.
With that, Madam Chair, I will move the -5 amendment.
Thank you. Be added to Senate Bill 171. Any further discussion? Any objection? Hearing none, Senate Bill 171-5 amendment is added to Senate Bill 171.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Before people completely pack up, I guess I'd like to make one request of the committee. my conversation with, I think his name is Professor Bailey of the University of Oregon, raised some questions in my mind about the crafting of Senate Bill 171 vis-a-vis consumer protections in general. And as long as Mr. Sherman is here, I would appreciate it if he would allow me to ask him a couple questions about that.
We have a question that has occurred. Representative Ringo, thank you, Mr. Sherman.
Thanks very much, Madam Chair. Thanks for hanging around, Mr. Sherman. You heard my comments about was it Professor Bealy? Is that his
beer?
Beer. Okay, sorry. Who came up and discussed this? There he is. Yeah, in my office, and he made the comment that the work group's intent was to retain the status quo vis-a-vis consumer protections in general, and that historically Oregon afforded consumers less protection than other states did, based on the uniform Article 9, and therefore the revised Article 9 would continue with that practice in affording consumers slightly less protection than they might have in other states. And I'm just wondering if you could comment on that.
Well, I'd be happy to, Representative Ringo, Madam Chair. For the record, again, my name is Ken Sherman. We spent probably more time during the work group process talking about consumer issues and the relationship of old Article 9 to new Article 9 to those issues than probably any other subject. And I would again characterize what we ended up with as a very carefully crafted compromise with full participation from all interested parties in the process. There were people who didn't want to increase the consumer remedies provided in Article 9 at all. lots of people around the table had that approach and that perspective. That's not at all what we did. There are important new provisions, and we detailed those in the testimony we delivered on the initial appearance on this bill that pertain specifically to consumers. If you'd like, I can find that testimony and go back through those, but I just want to make the point that there are a number of new consumer provisions that are built into Part 6 of new Article 9 that we left in place without any change and that I think substantially increase consumer protection under this law. So my perspective is that we did a good, balanced job on that issue. There are some states that have simply wholesale rejected the new consumer provisions, and Oregon, under this bill, would not be one of them.
Madam Chair.
Representative Ringo.
Does the Article 9 version that you're proposing contain fewer consumer protections than are contained in the uniform Article 9?
The only substantive change that I can remember, and Professor Beer, who was a very important part of that that whole discussion, and others, Paul Cosgrove also is here, and he took a very leading role. And in fact, he chaired our consumer subcommittee, so he might be better able to testify to this. But the big change that we made from the uniform draft is in the section that we've just been talking about, the one where we ended up with this compromise increase in the minimum damage amount. We went from $350 to $1,000. That section in the uniform draft talks about the forfeiture of all interest plus 10% of the principal amount. And the point, I think, was very aptly made during our conversations about that, that a consumer transaction today may involve a $250,000 motor home, and the interest on a longer-term contract on such a motor home or a big boat or any other consumer pricey item can easily be the purchase price or more. So you're talking in that sort of a situation where you have perhaps a technical default under Part 6 of the requirements, a loss of maybe $250,000. We felt, and I think it was a pretty solid conclusion on the part of the whole work group, that that was out in left field, that that was a provision that was not consistent with Oregon practice.
Okay.
So that was the major change.
Madam Chair.
Thank you. Last question, Representative Ringel, please.
Except for the one example that you just gave, the 10% issue, can you think of other cases where Oregonians are afforded less protection under this proposed Article 9 from the uniform Article 9?
Not off the top of my head, and again, I might suggest that we bring Mr. Cosgrove up, and Professor Beer might have a comment on that too, but nothing comes to my mind at this point in terms of lesser consumer protection.
Okay, thank you. Madam Chair, could I ask that same question of Professor Beer?
Professor Beer, may I ask the same question?
Madam Chair, if I may, for the record, my name is Carl Beer from the University of Oregon. Representative Ringo, thank you very much for your care and careful attention to this bill, particularly in following up on my error last time. Perhaps, especially in light of that error, it demonstrates that this aspect of the bill is not my central expertise, and I think Mr. Sherman's suggestion that someone more directly involved with the subcommittee that worked on the consumer issues might be best to testify. But off the top of my head, no. The matter of the consumer penalty, which is the $1,000 amount versus the formula based on the size of the transaction, is the only substantive point that I can think of.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. Could I just make a comment before we move
yes,
on?
Yes, you may.
Thank you. I appreciate your addressing this, and to the extent that Mr. Sherman or Professor Beer, if you do think of other examples, I would appreciate it if you would notify my office, just because I would like to know. And Mr. Sherman, I entirely understand your concerns with that 10% issue. I mean, that does make sense to me. But if there are other areas out there where the consumer is receiving less attention, I would like to know.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Any further discussion? I entertain a motion.
Madam Chairman.
Representative Williams.
I would move this bill as amended to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Any further discussion? Representative Shetterly?
Madam Chair, just to say that I was feeling pretty good about this until I heard that Paul Cosgrove chaired the Consumer Protection Subcommittee. I trust it was widely representative of the... No, I think they've done a good job, and I commend them all for it, including and especially Mr. Cosgrove.
Thank you. Clerk will take the roll, please.
Representative Backlund?
Aye.
Representative Ringo?
Aye.
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 Chair Walker?
Aye. Senate Bill 171 has passed to the full committee.
Madam Chair,
I'd
just like to say that I will never again work on an Article 9 case when the Bonnie Sounds of Ireland don't sort of fade back into my memory.
Well, I think that will probably come to mind when we get on the House floor. We might want to have them show up and play music for us. Oh, my.
Well, that music, too.
Okay, who wants to carry this one now? This treasure.
Not me.
Not you?
I'd carry it. Do you want to carry it? I don't know.
Well, I thought of one of you who worked on it might want to.
Well, I've got my share today, ma'am.
Is that your share today?
What have I got? I got one, didn't I?
I think that either you or Representative Backlund, I think, would be appropriate choices.
Well,
I can carry it. I don't have one today. I'll carry it. Did you want to do it, Representative Shetterly?
No.
I'll carry it.
I'm not ashamed of it. I think it's a good bill. I just don't want to hog
Well, I thought someone who had invested a lot of time in this might want to do it. But
you can defer to Representative Williams.
I will do it.
Any question that stumps you.
Thank you. This hearing is adjourned.